and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the news of the day. First, a Russian warplane was shot down over Syria on Saturday, killing the pilot. The surface-to-air missile was fired by Al-Qaeda rebels, a dangerous development as the Trump administration brags that it has defeated ISIS in Syria. Next, today marks the 15th anniversary of the speech by then-Secretary of State Colin Powell to the United Nations Security Council that laid out the U.S. path to war against Iraq. Powell had told the UN definitively that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. That was not true, and the lie led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. Then, again this week, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines. And then we're going to talk about the latest news of the day regarding the so-called Nunes memo, the Democrats' minority memo, and a recently declassified referral from the Senate Judiciary Committee about a criminal accusation against Christopher Steele, the author of the now infamous Steele dossier. And finally, in a setback for leftist former President Rafael Correa, the Yes campaign succeeded on all questions in yesterday's referendum in Ecuador, pushed by current President Lenin Moreno, who is accused of betraying the Citizens' Revolution movement that brought him to power. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A Russian warplane was shot down over Syria on Saturday, and the pilot was killed. The surface-to-air missile was fired by Al-Qaeda rebels, a dangerous development as the Trump administration brags that it has defeated ISIS in Syria. We're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. Mark, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Oh, the pleasure's ours. So I guess the easiest question is, why is it that the media can't bring itself to say that the Syrian rebels are Al-Qaeda?
Because the Western media has, from the very beginning of this conflict, sided with those who are trying to violently overthrow the Syrian government. And this is, of course, because the U.S. has long supported. They have illegally armed, trained, and salaried Obama's CIA to the tune of $1 billion a year, as reported by the Washington Post, to arm, train, and salary sectarian militants who have, from the beginning of the conflict, been allied and embedded with Al-Qaeda. And actually, before they were against ISIS, they were also allied with ISIS. That was early on in the conflict. So they have maintained this fiction from the beginning. And at the here in this endgame in Idlib, this is even more egregious, because even Western, the foremost Western academics on Syria, who are extremely anti-Syrian government, I'm thinking in particular of Sam Heller at the Century Foundation, have long admitted that Idlib is completely controlled by Al-Qaeda, going currently by its latest iteration branding, HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, previously known as the Nusra Front. But even the U.S. government admits that this group is not linked to Al-Qaeda, are not rebels, they are Al-Qaeda. And when the Washington Post and other mainstream media sources do this and continually refer to groups Al-Qaeda and those who operate under its umbrella as rebels, they are doing what amounts to propaganda, and they are even flying in the face of the U.S. government. Now, there are two U.N. Security Council resolutions demanding that ISIS and Al-Qaeda and every group, individual, and endeavor associated with Al-Qaeda and ISIS be eradicated, explicitly eradicated. But the Washington Post and much of the Western mainstream media continues to run cover and continually uses this term rebels, which obviously has a completely different connotation.
That's Mark Sloboda. He's an international security and affairs analyst. We're talking to him from Moscow. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. The Washington Post, which says in the first line of the article, Syria's former Al-Qaeda affiliate claimed responsibility Saturday for the downing of the airplane, It has a picture, a big picture on Saturday of the smoldering ruins of the Russian plane. And the headline over the picture is Syrian rebels take credit for shooting down Russian warplane. Now, just imagine if this was an American warplane in Syria and Al-Qaeda shot it down. Can you imagine? I mean, yeah, the war.
To be clear, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham has publicly claimed shooting it down. The group operating under their umbrella, they used to be a separate group, Jaish al-Nasser, is a former CIA-backed group that now has sworn an open oath of loyalty and operates under al-Qaeda. They have been given man pads by the U.S. in the past. They were armed and salaried by Obama's CIA. They are now most likely being supplied by Turkey or through maybe some other GCC countries that still supply money, arms, and supplies.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that because here we have the United States. And the point I was making, which I think everyone kind of knows where I was going. I mean, if Al-Qaeda shoots down an American warplane, they're not called rebels or militants. They're called Al-Qaeda terrorists. And for the last 17 years, the war on terror, which is a banner or a slogan used by the U.S. to justify whatever it wants to do, occupying, invading, bombing, carrying out drone attacks. I mean, that's been the thing. It's been fighting Al-Qaeda. But now they're rebels because they shot down a Russian plane. But let's go back to what they used to shoot this plane down. You mentioned man pads. That's man portable air defense system. These are shoulder-held surface-to-air missiles. Didn't the U.S. go to Libya, send specialized units to Libya to make sure that these missiles did not get into the hands of Al-Qaeda-like terrorists or Al-Qaeda themselves? I mean, where did they come from? You mentioned Turkey. You also mentioned the GCC. That's, of course, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf monarchies. Go ahead. Or it could have been Israel. I mean, who supplies these kind of dangerous weapons?
This is the problem, is so many people could be supplying it. The U.S. Was infamous for supplying Stinger missiles to many of the same type of jihadis, their progenitors in Afghanistan in the 1980s, which was fairly devastating to Russian aircraft, helicopters, and others in Afghanistan. And some 600 of these were never accounted for, according to many reports, after the conflict in Afghanistan, where the U.S.-backed jihadis in overthrowing the socialist government in Afghanistan. There are many primary producers of these, in particular the United States, Russia, and China, but they have spread out through the black market. The U.S. has supplied man pads and the more modern variations to Saudi Arabia and many of its other allies. In 2014, the Wall Street Journal reported that Saudi Arabia had supplied man pads to the jihadis that they were backing in Syria. And they were quite explicit. They quoted anonymous Western and Arab diplomats on this, that they, in Turkey and Jordan, there were actually warehouses full of these things. And this is the Wall Street Journal reporting, according to Western and Arab diplomats, that were waiting to be released to the conflict. Now, we have Russian Federation Council, like the Russian Senate, officials on the Defense Committee who have spoken out and said that they know that from intelligence that man pads have been transferred from a neighboring country, which can only be Turkey at this point, to these jihadis in Idlib, Idlib province in Syria, this mountainous region. And they know that it was done from the U.S., which is unconfirmed. We don't know that for certain, but that's what the Russians are saying, and that it was through a third country. This could be from the United States, through Saudi, through Turkey, to literally Al-Qaeda and those openly associating with them in Idlib.
And I think that's exactly what happened. The State Department issued a statement this morning saying that the U.S. government did not provide these man pad rockets directly to Al-Qaeda, But
yeah, caveat there. We did not provide them to the rebels.
They filled out an invoice that said Al-Qaeda, 25 man pads.
And imagine being in a position where you have to actually say publicly that you did not provide missiles to Al-Qaeda. But they did.
Well, it has to be said that the U.S. has provided advanced anti-tank weapons, TOWs, to Saudi Arabia, and also directly to some of the same rebel groups like this Jaish al-Nasser that are now operating under al-Qaeda. So, I mean,
that's right.
This pretense of one degree of remove, whether it's Saudi Arabia, whether it's Turkey, or whether it's through sectarian militants openly allied and embedded with al-Qaeda, the U.S. has supplied advanced weapons to terrorists in Syria. And the only question is, did they supply these weapons? Did they go through unofficial, these degrees of remove, or were these acquired on the black market after they were acquired elsewhere, but, likely also through Saudi and, through that via the U.S. But, the end source of these weapons is most likely the U.S. or Saudi Arabia, some combination of the two of them.
A deafening silence, John Kiriakou, from the Democrats.
Oh, yes.
The Republicans, the corporate-owned media, about al-Qaeda using advanced weapons that maybe probably were supplied either by the United States or a United States ally. A deafening silence.
Go right ahead, 30 seconds.
Yeah. The Washington Times, L. Todd Wood, former U.S. Air Force Academy, who flew for SEAL Team 6 and Delta Force, has an article in the Washington Times. He says the manpad Rubicon has been crossed, and he believes, he says openly, he believes that this is the U.S. government, whether it's the Trump administration or elements of the deep state, that are sending Russia a signal.
And
likewise, Turkey is also extremely upset that the U.S. continues.
That's important.
That Russia continues to bomb their al-Qaeda allies in Idlib.
Yep, another situation that's only going to get worse. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We were joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. Mark is an international affairs and security analyst. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today marks the 15th anniversary of the speech by then-Secretary of State Colin Powell to the United Nations Security Council that laid out the U.S. path to war against Iraq. Powell had told the U.N. definitively that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. That was not true. And the lie led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. We're joined from Washington by Medea Benjamin. She's a legendary peace activist and the co-founder of Code Pink. Medea, thanks for joining us.
Yes, thanks for having me on and for remembering this treacherous day so many years ago.
It is an ignominious day, one that Colin Powell now calls the greatest regret of his long career. That doesn't bring back to life the hundreds of thousands of people who died as a result of this war and the resulting starvation and lack of medicine that the Iraqis continued to experience for more than a decade. What are your thoughts on this day?
I recall being in Baghdad at the very time when he was speaking before the United Nations, and I was in a room that was called the Ministry of Information at that time under Saddam Hussein with reporters from all over the world. It was just packed. It was a wild scene. And we were watching live as Colin Powell was speaking at the UN, and the reporters in that room had been to every one of those places that he had pointed out as a place where there was some kind of weapon of mass destruction being stored or some elements of it. And they were watching very closely. And at the end of his horrible performance, they turned around to each other and said, "There's no way the U.S. can invade Iraq on that kind of flimsy, ridiculous information. We've been to those places. There's nothing there." And for a moment, I felt a bit of relief, like maybe the world had seen through the lies. And then the next day was when President Bush said, okay, you know, now we've got the evidence, we're going to go ahead. And the people in Iraq were just terrified. We were staying at a hotel, and the women in the hotels who were working there came up to us crying, what are we going to do? How can we protect our children? It was a terrible situation to be in, knowing that Colin Powell had lied to the world and knowing that this was just a justification for doing what the U.S. government had wanted to do anyway, and that there was no way that the Iraqi people could protect themselves from what was about to come.
7 weeks after Colin Powell's infamous speech to the U.N., the U.S. did initiate the shock and awe invasion. Shock and awe, by the way, is a term that the slave owners in America used in the Deep South when they wanted to impress rebellious slaves about their willingness to use unmatched violence and brutality against them as a lesson to others. But Medea Benjamin, who is our guest, I know we were all there organizing as you were in Baghdad at that moment. People were organizing all around this country and all around the world to try to stop this carnage from happening. The next day, that would be tomorrow, February 6, 2003, the Washington Post had an editorial, and I want to read a few words of it to you and for our audience. The headline is, very notably, irrefutable. After Secretary of State Colin Powell's presentation to the UN Security Council yesterday, it is hard to imagine how anyone could doubt that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction. Mr. Powell left no room to argue seriously that Iraq has accepted the Security Council's offer of, quote, a final opportunity, close quote, to disarm. And he offered a powerful new case that Saddam Hussein's regime is cooperating with a branch of the Al-Qaeda organization that is trying to acquire chemical weapons and stage attacks in Europe. Joseph Biden Jr., the senior Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, called it, quote, powerful and irrefutable. So we have George W. Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, all parts of the Bush administration. But then you have the Washington Post, you had Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden. They all said the same thing. And Medea, for all of us who were paying attention to Iraq at the time, we all knew, just as those journalists knew in the room that you were in Baghdad, that this was all a lie. It wasn't like a mystery at all. This was a slam dunk about being a lie. Go ahead.
Well, I was actually surprised that the U.S. hadn't planted weapons of mass destruction or something that they could actually bring out and say, here it is. And I kept sort of waiting for that to happen, which it didn't. It do. And in some ways, you know, it was just the smokescreen of Colin Powell and the kind of prestige that he had that lent some, and as you say, the way the U.S. media was echoing this, that lent some credibility to this scenario. And we, as you said, we're all organizing like crazy, not only in the United States, but around the world. The global community knew that this was made up. The global community knew that this was going to be disastrous. It's not like we were supporting Saddam Hussein. It's that we were, that we knew what a U.S. invasion would entail. I would say we didn't know, at least I didn't know, how horrendous would be the aftermath, and the fact that so many years later we are still looking at a situation where Iraq is so unstable, where people are still suffering so much, and where so many civilians have died and been displaced. I must say that I didn't have any idea just how horrific the aftermath would be.
Medea, I came at this from a completely different angle. I was at the Central Intelligence Agency at the time, working specifically on Iraq. And this whole weapons of mass destruction issue, Brian, people in the halls at the CIA called it the big lie. I mean, they just admitted it openly to one another. This was all a lie that was being perpetrated by the Bush administration. I actually write about it in my first book. And I remember the night of the Powell speech, a senior CIA officer saying, if they have flipped Powell, Iraq is doomed. And that's exactly what happened. There were these odd battle lines drawn inside the Bush administration at the time, It was the CIA, the Joint Chiefs, and the State Department that were opposed to this invasion of Iraq, bureaucratically opposed. But the Office of the Vice President, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and the National Security Council were the ones making the policy. And they had determined, before there was even any discussion of weapons of mass destruction, that they were going to attack Iraq, overthrow Saddam Hussein, and then establish the largest air force base in the world in southern Iraq so that we could move all of our air assets out of Saudi Arabia and then deprive Osama bin Laden of the ability to say that the U.S. was polluting the land of the two holy mosques. So Saddam Hussein had no chance from the beginning. This decision was made, and weapons of mass destruction were just the straw man that was being used to justify this thing.
Go ahead, Medea.
Well, I remember talking to many Iraqis in the times that we were there, both that time and subsequent, who some of them had been terribly repressed by Saddam Hussein. But they were saying to us from the very beginning that they did not want the U.S. to, quote, liberate them, that they never believed that the United States was there to try to bring a democracy to them. And as we traveled there in the years afterwards, seeing, for example, the setup that the U.S. Tried to impose on the Iraqi people, and that continues to some extent to this day, pillaging the country, of, as John said, using it as a base for U.S. Military. And I think the craziness of the United States to think that it could just take over the Iraqi government. As we've seen since then, it hasn't worked out. In fact, the subsequent governments that have been in place have been more favorable to Iran, the U.S. enemy. But nevertheless, the ones who have really suffered from all of this is the Iraqi people. And what really breaks my heart is how little the Americans seem to care, the American people seem to know or to care about what we have done to that nation, how much we owe the Iraqi people. If there were justice in this world, the billions of dollars in reparations that we would be paying to Iraq today.
Medea Benjamin is our guest on this, the 15th anniversary of Colin Powell's famous, infamous speech to the UN, which the Washington Post said the next day proved irrefutably that the Iraqi government was a grave threat to peace, that it had weapons of mass destruction, that it was linked to Al-Qaeda. Medea, in our last 90 seconds, I interviewed Lawrence Wilkerson, who is Colin Powell's chief of staff in the first 4 years of the Bush administration. I said, look, Iraq was surrounded. Iraq was hobbled by 13 years of sanctions. It was the most inspected country in the world. Why was the decision taken to invade Iraq? You guys knew that it wasn't a threat. And he said, well, it was the low-hanging fruit, meaning the Bush administration could invade because it could invade. In other words, it just could do it militarily. And then when you think back to all of the suffering that you're talking about, I mean, unimaginable suffering for people, I think, in the United States. And still, there's no accountability for any of those obvious lies and the war of aggression that followed therein. Go ahead, in our last minute.
Yes, I wish that you would ask the same thing to Colin Powell, because Larry Wilkerson has since been really speaking out amazingly against not only what happened then, but what the U.S. government is doing today. But Colin Powell, while he says he regrets what he did, I would like to see him speaking out and joining us in a movement to stop U.S. militarism.
All right, we're going to leave it there, John Kiriakou.
Yes, we were joined from here in Washington by Medea Benjamin. Medea is a legendary peace activist and the co-founder of Code Pink. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We will be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines in the press. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Patt. He's an independent journalist whose searing critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. Steve, welcome back.
Good to be back.
John, just to say, though, before we start, and some of them are not just terrible and misleading. Some of them are just downright silly. But
yeah.
let's start with a worst and misleading. Ugh. This one's Russia strikes back as Syrian rebels take credit for shooting down fighter jet killing pilot. Well, that's a serious story, but Steve Pat, talk about that headline. It's the Washington Post.
Well, of course, the misleading part is the rebels part. The article, remarkably, in the very first sentence, makes clear that this was Al-Qaeda doing the shooting. But during the article, they also refer to rebels and militants, and the headline refers to rebels. So you can just imagine that.
Okay, let's think about a Washington Post headline, John and Steve. Let's say Al-Qaeda shot down, I don't know, like an American plane.
Imagine. Imagine the fallout.
Let's hear the Washington Post. And America's going to strike back. The headline would be, America strikes back as rebels take credit for shooting down fighter jet and killing the pilot. Can you imagine?
Never.
No. I don't think so. And by the way, this could happen in Syria.
I mean, here,
oh, it sure could.
I mean, here the war on terror, the so-called war on terror, which is nothing more than a banner, a slogan justifying U.S. going wherever it wants to invade, occupy, bomb, use drone attacks, targeted assassinations. But it was all about Al-Qaeda, right? It was all about Al-Qaeda's attack on September 11th. Russia strikes back as Syrian rebels take credit for shooting down fighter jet. And then you're reading the first line, Syria's former Al-Qaeda affiliate, they just changed their name, but it's Al-Qaeda, claimed responsibility Saturday for downing of a Russian warplane in northern Syria, apparently using a surface-to-air missile to target the aircraft. And that's not that funny either, because that means those surface-to-air missiles that Al-Qaeda now has came from somewhere.
Was undoubtedly a U.S. ally or the U.S. itself.
Yeah, maybe Libya, maybe the U.S., maybe Israel. Anyway, we're going to call that just our most disgusting headline for the week. Let's go on to some others, Steve.
That's for sure. Okay, let's turn to culture for a minute. This was a headline from my local paper, the San Jose Mercury News, and it's about a musical that's starting in San Jose. And the headline is, A Revolution Told in Song.
That sounds beautiful. Oh, my God.
It has, and I thought it's another, you know, takeoff on Hamilton. It's about the American Revolution. No.
Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Could it be the Russian Revolution? Russian Revolution? No. Actually, it's the Ukrainian Revolution. So what we have here is a musical celebration of a fascist-led coup, which is like, it's like Springtime for Hitler, only it's not a joke.
Springtime for Hitler was the anthem in the producers.
Hilarious.
Very funny. But also completely ironic. But Steve Pat's right. The revolution, the song, A Revolution Told in Song, that was literally, for our audience that might not know, fascist. Yes, fascist and neo-Nazis in Kiev seized the power from a corrupt but still democratically elected government, the government of Yanukovych, on February 22nd, 2014. And, of course, John McCain and Victoria Nuland, the Secretary of State, who had been formerly Hillary Clinton's State Department spokesperson, said, a new day for Ukraine, and it was a fascist-led military coup d'etat. Okay, A Revolution Told in Song.
And now it's a musical.
And now it's
by the way, they're putting up statues to Nazis who exterminated Jews in Ukraine right now.
That's true. Also, not funny, another disgusting story, but the headline is, I don't know. Let's just call that disgusting, too. That's not funny. That's disgusting.
Let's switch to purely funny now from the business world. I love this headline. $1,000 iPhone X was called crazy. Now people are worried iPhone prices won't keep rising.
Okay, what? I think we all share that. I've been worried, John. Have you been worried that cell phones are going to, the price is going to drop?
I insist on spending $1,500 on a cell phone.
Me too.
Yes.
I mean, any self-respecting person would. Well, okay, Steve Pat, what does this mean? What is this headline?
Who are these quote-unquote people who think that prices should be higher? Well, if you read the article, which was from a tech publication, it was exactly one analyst who was worried about Apple's profits and that, you know, they wouldn't stay high enough. So he thinks they should keep raising their prices. So it's not really people at all. It's one guy who wants to make sure Apple keeps making a lot of money.
Okay, it's one guy, but that's a headline.
Yep.
Yes.
And they got away with it.
Okay, I want to go. There's a couple more that we want to do, but I'm seeing this one headline, Steve, Pat, which I think, again, they're funny and disgusting. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's a repeating pattern here. Tillerson,
yes.
Tillerson wraps Russia, China as, quote, imperial powers, close quote, in Latin America.
I actually laughed out loud when I read this article.
Yeah.
It's a laugh-out-loud headline. There's no
You know, ever
that.
Since the Russians, ever since the Russians adopted the Monroe Doctrine in 1815, this has been going on. It's 203 yeah. years now that the Russians have been acting as an imperial power in Latin America. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. Literally, this article came out on the same day that Tillerson was talking about a military coup in Venezuela and how he thought Maduro should resign. The president of Venezuela.
Oh, right. But he was, he was actually saying, he was calling for a military dictatorship.
Yes.
Yeah, a coup, yes.
Which, okay, you know what? Let's just think about U.S. military coups in Latin America. Let's see if we can name a few just to show that, in fact, Russia, I don't think Russia's carried out any military coups in Latin America, but let's talk about some of the American military coups. I'm thinking Guatemala, 1954. Brazil, 1964, Dominican Republic, 1965,
El Salvador.
Chile, 1973, that was Pinochet, 30,000 dead, CIA, Kissinger, Nixon, AT&T, Kennecott Copper, they're all in on it together. And then, of course, the American Contra War, where the United States sold weapons to Iran during the Iran-Iraq War and used the proceeds to arm former National Guardsman of the Somoza dictatorship to carry out a war against the Sandinista revolution. Anyway,
right, and we could come right up to the present in Honduras, where just a few years ago they supported a coup in Honduras, and now they're supporting what was clearly a flagrant electoral theft in Honduras just a few weeks ago. So it hasn't stopped.
Well, let me ask you, Steve, because I know you're on Radio Sputnik. And you know what that is. So
yeah,
you're obviously a Russia expert. How do you think Russia will react to being cited as an imperial power in Latin America by our Secretary of State?
I think the internet abbreviation is ROFL.
Rolling on the floor laughing.
I knew that. Okay, let's go to, I see a headline here that says, I'm rich and that makes me anxious. What is that?
I wouldn't know about that. But,
okay.
That was actually a good one. That was poor little rich people.
I was talking to some of my coworkers here, and they're not rich and feeling anxious.
Yeah.
So what's right. up with the rich person is feeling anxious?
It's these young Wall Street types who all of a sudden find themselves filthy rich, and it gives them anxiety. And how do they deal with having all this money? What should they do with it? It just makes them very upset.
And they also envision and anticipate, I think, in the article, that there may be a day when they're not super rich. Like, that is disconcerting. We have 2 minutes left, Steve.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you about the last headline for today. Again, funny and disgusting. Russia, Putin, : Kremlin accuses U.S. of meddling in election.
Yeah, this one caught my eye. First of all, this is the BBC.
This doesn't sound like English. Russia, Putin, : Kremlin.
They're supposed to be
accuses.
The guardian of language. My theory is this. They had an editorial meeting, and they tried to figure out what word in the headline would arouse the anger and distrust of their readers. So half of the people said, we should put Russia in the headline because people hate Russia. And the other half of the people said, we should put Putin in the headline.
What about Kremlin? What about the Kremlin? It could be the first three words are Russia, Putin, Kremlin. Oh, God. God, you're already hating everybody right there.
Exactly. They couldn't decide. Or my other theory is that it really was supposed to read Russia's Putin, but they left out the apostrophe S, but
right.
then I couldn't figure out what other Putin.
The Brits have terrible grammar, so that wouldn't surprise me, right? I mean, that's par for the course.
Yeah. Anyway, I guess this, as I said, I think this was meant to just distinguish it from Germany's Putin or Japan's Putin. This is Russia Putin.
All right. I think you're onto something. Steve Pat, I think we're out of time. Thank you for sharing. Well, it's not just the most disgusting and worst and misleading, but also ironic, funny headlines of the week. John, we're out of time.
That was Steve Pat. He joined us from the San Francisco Bay Area. Steve is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. It's lefteye.blogspot.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Over the next few minutes, we're going to talk about the latest news of the day regarding the so-called Nunes memo, the Democrats' minority memo, which is kind of a competing memo, and a recently declassified referral from the Senate Judiciary Committee about a criminal accusation against Christopher Steele, the author of the now infamous Steele dossier. Brian, the story seems to be moving so quickly that it's difficult to keep up with. What we're looking at now is a letter, a declassified letter of referral from the Senate Judiciary Committee chairman, Chuck Grassley, Republican senator of Iowa, and the chairman of the terrorism subcommittee. That's Lindsey Graham, another Republican. He's from South Carolina. And this referral is to Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, and Christopher Wray, who is the head of the FBI, saying that Christopher Steele either lied to the committee when he was called to testify or lied to a British court before he came to Washington to testify. So they are asking the FBI and the Justice Department to look into Christopher Steele with an eye toward charging him with a felony. The felony could be perjury, it could be making a false statement, or it could be contempt of Congress. Why do you think the committee decided to release this today? Is this just part of the Republicans' effort to, is this just a part of the Republican effort to attack Christopher Steele personally and sort of delegitimize him and his information?
The answer is yes and no, because of course the Republicans who are trying to fend off the so-called Russia probe, the Mueller probe, and the allegations of Russia-Trump collusion are releasing information, much of which may be true, about the role of Christopher Steele and the Democrats. They're doing it for political purposes. They're doing it to protect Donald Trump. So we have to sort of separate motive or intent from the actual factual developments. And it's kind of hard for the broad audience or anybody who's not paying very careful attention to make heads or tails out of it. Of course, for us, and I think we've emphasized this over and over again, as we did in the last hour, be that the FISA court, the secret court that the FBI used to get a surveillance warrant against Carter Page, who says he was a Trump volunteer. Trump actually cited him to the Washington Post as part of his foreign policy team, but somebody who Trump had actually never met. They got a warrant against him on the basis that he might be a, quote, Russian agent or working with Russians or something like that. And it turns out that a part of their representation to the FISA court was based on the dossier written by Christopher Steele, the ex-British intelligence agent who was hired by Hillary Clinton and the Democrats to go to Russia and to talk to Russians and perhaps to talk to Russian former intelligence agents or current Russian intelligence agents to collect dirt on Donald Trump. They did that, and perhaps they didn't fully represent to the FISA court that this information that they're presenting to the court was actually based on opposition research paid for by Clinton.
Right. In fact, that's one of the interesting things in this declassified referral. It says that, I'll read you the first paragraph from an article I'm looking at. The recently declassified referral from the Senate Judiciary Committee issued by Republican Senators Chuck Grassley and Lindsey Graham provides new insight into Steele's contacts while he was working on the anti-Trump dossier, revealing that he had written an additional memo apart from the dossier using the data received directly from the Clinton campaign. So you're right. It wasn't just opposition research, which is all fine and good because every presidential campaign conducts opposition research. But the Clinton campaign was specifically funneling this research to Christopher Steele, knowing that it was going into this dossier that was making its way back to the FBI.
John, it's really remarkable about how disingenuous the Clinton campaign and the DNC have been about all of this. I mean, they hired Christopher Steele to do opposition research to Trump. That research was then used by the FBI to go to the FISA court to get a warrant to surveil Carter Page. But Clinton was also very upset that the corporate-owned media didn't publicize before the election the research that she had paid for surreptitiously through Fusion GPS.
Right,
she was unhappy about that. In her book, she complains about the New York Times. Quote, in the summer of 2016, according to the Washington Post, the FBI convinced a special foreign intelligence surveillance court that there was probably cause to believe that Trump advisor Carter Page was acting as a Russian agent and received a warrant to monitor his communication. The FBI also began investigating a dossier prepared by a well-respected former British spy that contained explosive and salacious allegations about compromising information the Russians had on Trump. Now, the Washington Post, commenting about this, writes, note that Clinton described the dossier only as having been, quote, prepared by a well-respected British spy, as if the spy, Christopher Steele, had acted on his own. Clinton certainly gave no indication in her book that her campaign helped finance this work. There is a fundamental contradiction here. Again, this is a Washington Post reporter. Clinton wanted the dossier to be viewed as credible, yet she did not want to be connected to it. She hoped the media before Election Day would publish claims about Trump to which she was unwilling to attach her own name.
We shouldn't be at all surprised that this is how Hillary Clinton behaved, because the Clintons have been doing this kind of thing since the 1980s in Arkansas.
And perhaps all candidates do all, I mean, all the Democratic and Republican candidates.
It's certainly possible.
This is, I mean, and even Christopher Steele was originally hired, I think, by Republican rivals of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Then he got the nomination, and the DNC and Hillary Clinton picked it up. So Steele is a key factor in all of this. And he was originally hired, according to the Fusion GPS CEO's testimony before Congress. This is what Steele himself said. They asked me one question. They didn't have a roadmap. They asked me one question, and it was all about, what can you show us about why Donald Trump is connected to Russia? That's where this started, way back in the winter of 2016. And Steele went after the Russian connection, and he went to Russia. Again,
that's
he was
right.
Colluding with some, quote, Russians,
right,
to gather dirt on Donald Trump.
And in this declassified referral, it mentions his source or his subsource being a foreign national. We assume that it's a Russian national because we know that he went to Russia.
And far from providing clear analytical or vetted information about Donald Trump or anything, this was unvetted data. There was no analyst assuming or looking at whether this material was accurate or not, as would happen, say, within the FBI or the CIA normally.
That's right. Raw intelligence.
Yeah, and he's a paid-for guy. He's a mercenary, right?
That's right.
And then at the same time, you have, according to this this new allegation from Grassley, The DNC, that wasn't enough. The DNC was also feeding Steele stuff so he could put it in the dossier. In other words, they were doing their own sort of contribution to his seeming respected dossier from a respected intelligence agent.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Yeah. What they wanted was a self-fulfilling prophecy, that this circular reporting would take on a life of its own, that the implication would be that the reporting was coming from multiple sources, which it was not, and that it would eventually cripple the Trump campaign.
Right. And again, going back to Carter Page, Carter Page was met with in 2013 by the FBI. There was an interview where they told him, there's some Russian intelligence agents in New York who are trying to recruit you. So, you know, Carter Page knew he was under sort of scrutiny from the FBI way back when. So then he's a self-promoter. He goes to Russia and says, I'm a Trump campaign advisor. He's hustling, basically, but he never met Donald Trump.
No.
I mean, if he's the evidence of collusion between Russia and Trump, so far there's nothing there. And why, if he's been colluding, why isn't Carter Page indicted?
That's right.
You know, why? I mean, we have Michael Flynn. He's pled guilty to lying to the FBI, but not about collusion. I mean, where's the evidence? Again, still no evidence.
Nothing at all. Carter Page, there was an article about him over the weekend in the New York Times. He's speaking so freely to the public that the New York Times said it's either endearingly honest or recklessly foolish. I'm not sure which one it is yet, but he certainly is acting as though he has nothing to hide.
And according to the FBI documents, the Russian intelligence agents were not that interested in Carter Page back in 2013 when they met with him. And he said it was benign, but they called him an idiot.
An idiot.
And he says, yeah, that's me that they're talking about. So he's validated that part. And maybe, guess what? Maybe that's not so far wrong.
Well, we'll see as this thing plays out. We're out of time for this little conversation. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
In a setback for leftist former President Rafael Correa, the Yes campaign succeeded on all questions in yesterday's referendum in Ecuador, pushed by current President Lenin Moreno, who was accused of betraying the Citizens' Revolution movement that brought him to power. We're joined from London by independent journalist Denis Rogatyuk. Denis, welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot, John. Thanks a lot, Brian. It's great to be back.
Denis, this referendum called for a lot of different things, one of the most important of which was a limit of two terms for presidents of Ecuador. Correa opposed it, Moreno supported it, and it passed. Can you give us a little bit of the background on this referendum and what it means for Ecuador?
Sure. Well, first of all, we really have to look at just at all the seven questions in the referendum, because at first glance, it actually seems it does not seem like an overtly reactionary or a right wing. When we look at questions 1, 4, 5, and 7, there really isn't any. There doesn't seem to be anything right wing there at first, because the questions ask whether someone who has been accused of corruption should not stand for office. You know, whether sexual abuse of children should be banned. You know, if mining and oil exploration should not be conducted in urban centers, and if national parks should be protected. But the specifically two questions, 2, 3, and 6 are the ones that were most strongly opposed by Rafael Correa and by the militants and by his militants and by the supporters of the Citizens' Revolution. As you mentioned, yes, question 2 dealt specifically with getting rid of indefinite re-election. Now, the indefinite re-election was initially approved by Rafael Correa's government in December 2015, but it was not put into practice until April 2017, which meant that Correa himself was not able to stand in the presidential elections in 2017, and hence why it was Lenin Moreno's term. So this measure of once again getting rid of indefinite re-election was really a cynical measure by Lenin Moreno to prevent the return of Rafael Correa to presidency, since the next presidential elections are scheduled to be in 2021, and with this new law in place, technically Rafael Correa would not be able to stand, would not be a candidate on the election once again.
Denis, you make a point in your article that I think is important, and I've not seen it anywhere else in the mainstream media. You talk a little bit about Correa initially introducing a measure in May of 2015 to target super profits that are derived Correct. From the sale of land and real estate. So much of the land is owned by the wealthiest members of the population, and this tax was seen as a means to reduce the budget deficit. You go on to say that the tax was opposed by every major opposition party, and especially by politicians with ties to the banking industry and those that belong to landowning and property developing elites. Can you tell us a little bit about that and the role of this extreme capitalism in the Ecuadorian economy?
Certainly. Well, this was actually a part of the referendum as well. Question six actually asked the voters whether they wanted to get rid of the speculative tax which was implemented by Rafael Correa's government in 2015. Now, the speculative tax itself was specifically targeted at the sales of land and property that was not, I would say, by property developers, by landowners, that was not used for anything other than investment purposes, or as we can deduct from the name, from speculation. So it was not used for any purpose other than simply accumulation of wealth. So it was a measure designed specifically to weaken the political and economic power of the entrenched landowner and corporate elites. Now, what the reaction to this tax was actually quite extraordinary, considering that it only targeted approximately 0.5% of Ecuador's population. So throughout several months of 2015, we saw violent protests by some of the major right-wing opposition leaders. Among them have been Jaime Nebot, who was the right-wing mayor of Guayaquil. Others have been Guillermo Lasso, who is the head of the Bank of Guayaquil and a long-time opponent of Correa, as well as one of the ones who was principally regarded as behind the banking crisis of Ecuador in 1998-99, as well as Quito's mayor Mauricio Rodas, and other figures. Now, the fact that getting rid of the speculation tax was present in the current referendum indicates just how much leverage the right-wing opposition has acquired with the presidency of Lenin Moreno.
Dennis, let me ask you though. I mean, when you look at these different parts to the referendum, elimination of the indefinite re-election, that this would bar, I believe, Correa from running again, repeal of the prohibition of mining activity in urban centers, okay, repeal of the law taxing capital gains on land transfer. 64% of the people, these are early returns, I don't know if these are complete, 64% said yes to that, to repeal this progressive measure that would stop this sort of accumulation of massive wealth at one pole amongst the very, very small elites to the detriment of the population. Why such a big vote? Why such a big defeat for the left in this case?
Well, I wouldn't really call it a defeat, because we have to remember that the yes vote was it was headed by Lenin Moreno and the government, but we have to remember that the yes vote was backed by the ruling Alianza País party, which was, even though it was created by Rafael Correa, and Lenin Moreno won his presidency with its support, but it has since, the majority of it has been captured by Lenin Moreno and his loyalists. So we have every single right-wing party in existence in Ecuador also backing the referendum. We have every single private media outlet, from the newspapers like El Comercio, El Universo, the TV stations like Tele Amazonas, Ecuavisa. We have we basically have every single representative and every single face of neoliberal power within Ecuador, you know, pushing their weight behind this campaign. And on the other side, on the no side, what we have is basically just Rafael Correa and the militants and activists, as well as members of National Assembly who decided to split from Alianza País Party and join him, coordinating this campaign for no, because the yes vote for them very much represented a return to the past. And it's not hard to see, because you had figures like former presidents Abdallah Bucaram and Lucia Gutierrez actively campaigning for a yes. So I wouldn't really see this as a defeat for the left, but rather see this as showing that 36% of the population have refused to believe this new parable.
It's going to be the beginning, I think, of a lot of controversy. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Dennis, you've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.